Chapter 58. The warden escorted Michael through a dank, concrete-lined corridor. Thick, sealed doors lined the walkway, each fitted with a viewing portal. An automaton was monitoring the other inmates. It slid one of the portals open, briefly flooding the corridor with light, before snapping it shut. Michael blinked and mumbled, overwhelmed by the sensory stimulation. He walked like he was drunk, his brain no longer sure how to handle straight lines. The warden deposited Michael in a dressing room where his clothes were waiting. It was the same suit he'd worn to court. It took several minutes for him to change in the cramped cube, vaguely remembering how to use buttons and fasten a tie. The fabric hung looser than he remembered, and he had to slide the belt to its tightest notch. Flecks of color shot across his vision like his brain was short-circuiting. Was it his imagination, or was the bulb overhead getting darker? Michael squinted at the plaque to his side. Sensory readjustment cubicle 4. Above it was a smooth, flat surface, diffusing from matte black to dark silver as a mirror formed before him. Michael whimpered, seeing himself for the first time in decades. He pressed his gnarled fingers to his creased face in disbelief. Contours sank deep across his cheeks and brow. His eyes were yellow, and his hair had thinned to a few white wisps. The warden escorted him through security to the edge of the prison grounds. The building was like a giant golf ball, a pure white sphere covered in hexagonal dimples. Michael had often wondered how many others were being held in the substructures within. He'd not seen or heard another inmate or employee in all his time there. He wanted to ask the warden many things, but couldn't remember how conversations began. So they walked in silence to the front gates, with the warden supporting Michael by the arm as he swayed. Buzzing the turnstiles open, he ushered Michael through. Michael's face was wrought with concern. Where was he to go? Familiar with such panicked looks, the warden waved him on his way with a curt explanation. Your family are collecting you. With that, the door buzzed shut, and the light flicked red. The warden departed, leaving Michael blinking in the sun. He peered around for his family, but they were nowhere to be seen. From the edge of the parking lot, a suited stranger waved at him.
Michael! Over here! She called.
The woman marched over to meet him as he shuffled closer in bemusement. She threw her arms around him tightly. Michael gasped at the brush of another human's skin on his. The stranger stepped back, framing him in her arms, smiling at him adoringly.
Taylor,
said Michael with disbelief. She beamed at him.
I was worried you wouldn't recognize me.
But you're... Look at you,
he stammered. All trace of the floppy, clumsy, dependent kid dolt was gone. Here was a competent, composed businesswoman. Behind her, the passenger door opened, and a second woman climbed out. She also looked familiar. Her face was hard set, fierce and angry. Those eyes, those cheeks, they brought impossible memories flooding back.
Kelsey,
gasped Michael. The woman shook her head, uttering a cold, bitter laugh.
Sorry to disappoint you, Dad, said Olive.
Michael's head spun as he processed his mature daughter standing before him. The last time he saw her, she was a semester into college. Now she looked like she held tenure as a professor. Michael gazed from her to Taylor in astonishment.
How is this possible?
He croaked.
We've got some catching up to do, Dad. 50 years worth, to be precise.
Olive stared at him, unsmiling. There was a blazing resentment in her eyes. She shook her head, bit her lip, and briskly walked away to regain composure. She didn't want to vent all her frustration in one immediate tirade. There would be plenty of time for that.
She'll be okay. She just needs time, whispered Taylor.
Taylor, you're...
Better?
Michael nodded, searching her face with amazement.
I have Olive to thank for that. She perfected Kelsey's formula, smiled Taylor.
How?
Squawked Michael. Years of disuse had rendered his voice strange and angular.
The very act of conversation felt like a trance. No idea how she did it. You'll have to ask her yourself, grinned Taylor.
Will she talk to me?
Said Michael.
I can still hear you, you know, snapped Olive.
Will you, then?
Repeated Michael.
I don't know, Dad. I guess it hangs on whether I can forgive you for pleading guilty when you didn't have to, and getting yourself shut away for basically our whole lives. Do you know what it's been like? We had to make do without you or Mom. It didn't have to be that way, but you chose to make it like that. You missed my wedding, my children being born, their entire childhoods, their weddings, their kids growing up. You missed it all. When we drove here, I was almost excited to see you. But now I'm just angry. I don't recognize you at all. It's like I have no idea who you are. I'm not sure I ever did.
Did any of them die?
What?
Your family. Your brother's families.
No. That's such a weird thing to...
Then it worked. It was all worth it,
breathed Michael. For the first time in 50 years, the tightness in his chest was gone. He closed his eyes and exhaled freely, feeling the wind running through his wispy hair. Fresh air, cut grass, a dusty road, birdsong, the sun on his ashen skin. All these sensations bombarded his senses and he smiled, drinking them in.
It was worth it? Fumed Olive, breaking his daydream. You're seriously gonna stand there with one goddamned arm looking about 1,000,000 years old and tell me it was worth it?
New York, it's worked. We made it through the penitence,
said Michael.
Unbelievable, said Olive, storming off to the car. She'll come around. I am glad to have you back, Micka, grinned Taylor.
Offering her arm, she escorted him to the car.
There are a lot of excited grandkids waiting to meet you.
An hour's drive later, they were home. Michael's lip trembled as he shuffled out of the car to a place he recognized instantly. Olive hung back, having not said a word on the entire car ride home. She let Taylor assist Michael from the car to her house. The picket fence had been replaced with hedgerow and the large paving slabs replaced with ornate checkered tiles. But the house looked much the same, albeit now clad in a small forest of wisteria. He and Kelsey had saved hard to afford this place. It held so many of their memories, good and bad. Michael's eyes lingered on the enamel pipe protruding from the ground and the mailbox atop it.
Looks like we're both still standing,
he muttered. Taylor led him to the living room, which was rammed with faces Michael didn't recognize.
Everyone, there's someone you've all been waiting to meet. To four of us, he's father. To many of you, he'll be not just grandfather, but great-grandfather. This is Granddad Michael, she declared.
The room fell silent. Michael blushed, casting his eyes around the unfamiliar people who were eyeing him up like he'd landed from another planet.
Granddad Michael! Cheered a man, toasting him.
His enthusiasm broke the ice and triggered a ripple of toasts, which escalated into full applause and whooping from all corners. From the grateful smile Taylor gave, Michael inferred that the instigator was her husband. With the ice broken, the stranger's frowns turned to smiles of relief and warmth. Tiny infants threw themselves around Michael's leg with a giggle, nearly knocking him over, before their parents apologetically plucked them away. Michael glimpsed a piece of scrunched paper in one of the child's hands. It looked almost floral. Before he could look in detail, Taylor was ushering him into a chair, where a piece of cake materialized in his hand. Two elderly women pressed through the crowd of youngsters and stood before him. Michael frowned, piecing their faces together. His jaw dropped.
Sophia? Nina?
He gasped.
Don't you take that line with me, big brother. We look fantastic for our age. You're the one with a face like an accordion,
grinned Sophia. She leaned closer, hugging his head to her chest. As he squeezed her arm gratefully, a bald man with glasses approached. Nina and Sophia slipped away, giving Michael space with the newcomer.
"Hey, Dad," he said awkwardly.
"Damien,"
said Michael, flabbergasted.
"Minus the hair," he grinned. Michael did a double take.
The aged bald man in front of him was the same tousle-haired lad he'd left behind 50 years ago. He'd missed an entire lifetime.
"Oh, and this is my partner and our soon-to-be adult daughter, Hope," said Damien.
A kindly-looking woman came forwards and bowed to Michael. Before her, sitting pertly in a wheelchair, was their daughter. Judging by the age gap, she must have been born when Damien and his wife were in their early 40s, almost 20 years ago. Their daughter's bony knees showed beneath a thin blanket. A withered hand rested across her lap. With her functioning arm, she reached forwards and gave Michael a warm handshake with the maturity of a young college student.
"It's so wonderful, finally meeting you, Granddad Michael. I've heard so much about you."
Hope's words were clipped, like she was out of breath. But her smiling eyes brimmed with energy. Michael's mind flashed back to the Memorial Park and the statuette of the son he'd never known. The similarity was uncanny. He clasped his granddaughter's hand with warmth and sorrow. Guilt welled inside him as he met her bright, engaging gaze. This was the child Kelsey had denied them when she switched their unknown boy out for baby Olive. Decades later, the child was back, in a new guise, this time in his son's family. Was the ministry punishing Damien's family for Kelsey's sins? A timer chimed on the girl's wheelchair.
"Time for an injection. It was lovely meeting you, Granddad. See you again," she wheezed.
Damien wheeled her about and they headed off to find some space. Michael watched them go, confounded by guilt. He didn't have long to dwell, for another set of grandchildren swiftly approached, proudly paraded by a now adult Leon, who was, by the looks of it, a fashion designer. His partner and their children must have all received children as young adults, because their entire mini-clan was conspicuous in the room by its avant-garde finely cut attire, and it spanned two additional generations, three sets of fashionista parents in their late 20s and their assorted rabble of under-10s. Michael's eyes lingered on Leon's wife's earrings. He couldn't quite make them out behind her flowing hair, but it almost looked like a set of gilded orchids. She blushed, following his gaze, and hastily combed her hair forwards, obscuring them from view. Leon cottoned on, and the pair whisked their own grandchildren away, muttering a mishmash of excuses about getting food and drink. Fresh relatives replaced them, with reunions and introductions coming thick and fast throughout the afternoon. Michael kept pinching himself, expecting the room to rotate and the colors and people to dissolve at any moment, returning him to the bleached white of his chamber. After 50 years in isolation, hallucinations had become his bread and butter. The only thing assuring him this occasion was real was the taste of actual bread and butter, as Taylor dutifully refilled his plate with fresh scones and hot tea. Despite the regular sugar injections, by 4 p.m. Michael was exhausted. The tidal wave of social interaction had drained him. Still, he felt a strong sense of pride. The family had flourished because of him, because of his offerings, and the system he'd devised in prison. But for all the reunions, there was one absent friend he wanted to check on. Michael excused himself for a bathroom break, reassuring Taylor that he could manage unaided. Alone in the corridor, he shuffled to a familiar doorway. It was unlocked. Placing a mottled hand on the banister, he descended step by aching step. The familiar musty smell of damp concrete and wood greeted him like an old embrace. The basement had been cleared out substantially since he was last there. His eyes gravitated towards the small stack of original items which had been carefully preserved on a shelf and lovingly kept free of dust. Michael's eyes moved past the charred chocolate tin to the suitcase where he had stashed Toma's mechanical body. The case was much lighter than it should have been, and almost completely silent to move. With trepidation, he opened it up.
Michael gasped. Thousands of origami flowers filled the container. Some were pure white, others were speckled with blood. He shook his head in disbelief as the scale of the betrayal sank in. Grabbing the suitcase, Michael dragged it upstairs, spilling paper flowers as he went. He forced his way into the center of the living room, silencing the guests.
"What is the meaning of this?"
he demanded.
"You tell me, Dad. You're the one who made them," shrugged Olive.
"I want to know why in hell's name they're here."
"You can thank Taylor for that. I was going to chuck them in the trash, but she insisted on keeping them safe until you were released." "Glad to see you're being an ungrateful ass, as predicted."
"I'm ungrateful! I did this for your protection, for all of you," cried Michael.
"Folding a bunch of flowers?"
"Right," scoffed Olive.
"I kept a covenant with the ministry. They gave me the paper. I made the offering, and together we kept you all safe. It was simple, until you went and ruined it."
"Here we go," groaned Olive.
"You don't believe me. Why else would they give me paper each day?"
Maybe so you could write to us, you loon?"
"You people never wrote to me,"
snapped Michael.
"We weren't allowed to."
"And Toma? What did you do with Toma's body? It was in the suitcase. We needed to protect."
Concerned whispers echoed across the room as the extended family tried to fathom who Toma was and why Michael thought there was a body in the basement.
"Somebody answer me!"
he demanded, wild-eyed.
"The ministry took it, okay?" fumed Olive. "It was the same detective that arrested you. She came to the house after you were sentenced. She had a warrant to search for the missing machine, and her team found it in the basement. Your basement."
"This is bad,"
stammered Michael, looking at the pile of undelivered offerings.
"This is really bad. They won't like this at all. We have to move these, quickly."
"What?"
"We have to deposit these right away. All of you are in danger."
"I knew this gathering was a bad idea. You're clearly not ready for—"
"There's a secret hatch. A door. There's no time to explain. You'll see when we get there."
"No, Dad. We won't. Because we're not coming," said Olive, folding her arms.
"What?"
blinked Michael.
"We made a pact before your release. That once you were out, we wouldn't tolerate any of your unhealthy behaviors. It's not good for anyone, least of all you."
But this is different. This is urgent,"
protested Michael.
"Really? Or is it just another one of your weird, baseless superstitions? If your little origami project kept you going while you were in prison, that's terrific for you. But the rest of us were trying to get on with our lives and do our best to deal with raising our own families, launching our own careers, finishing school, and all the stuff you should have been there for."
"Every minute these offerings remain here puts us all in danger," urged Michael.
"Says the guy who just got out of prison for trying to blow up an entire neighborhood."
Michael scooped up the spilled flowers, then zipped up the case. He dragged it to the front door, his estranged family watching in bemusement.
"Mika, let's talk about this," begged Taylor.
"Do you want me to die? Is that it? Do you want each other to die?"
he cried.
"No, of course not. That's not what Olive was—"
"I did this all for a reason,"
he grunted, struggling out into the yard.
"Where are you going?"
said Taylor, concerned.
"To fix this before we face the consequences,"